we need to move quickly, which means that we need to use the existing systems that are in place in countries and not just create a lot of new programs outside the system that take time to develop.
I don't think we can let the perfect be the enemy of the good right now. There's urgency to getting some of these programs out. Time is really of the essence, and so now is the time to act.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The economic impact of COVID-19 in low and middle-income countries puts the onus on policymakers to protect the most vulnerable members of society and to do it quickly. But both these goals are difficult in normal times, and this is not a normal time. I'm joined today by Rima Hanna of the Harvard Kennedy School, where she is co-director of Evidence for Policy Design, and her colleague Ben Olken at MIT, where he is director of the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab. As you can guess, both have written extensively about what evidence-based policies to support the vulnerable through COVID-19 would look like. Rima and Ben, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Ben, even without COVID-19, the most vulnerable in low-income countries face a daily battle just to survive. So how does the current crisis raise those stakes?
I think that the current crisis really raises the stakes immensely, particularly in the developing world, where many people don't have much of a cushion to fall back on. And you can think of it in two ways. The first is a lot of countries are asking their citizens to socially distance. And whether that's a full lockdown or a partial lockdown or just some additional social distancing, that's going to mean that those people are going to have a lot of their sources of income evaporate or be reduced. But secondly, even for those who are not engaged in social distancing, or even for countries that don't lock down fully, I think it's become pretty clear that we're in the midst of a global economic shock, which is going to be very severe. You know, many people are talking about something as severe as the Great Depression or something on that order of magnitude. So even for countries that aren't directly locking down, they're also going to be hit by this sort of massive economic shock. Either way, there's a really urgent need for additional social protection, both right now in this sort of immediate kind of most acute phase of the economic crisis, but also in a more longer run as countries are dealing with this economic shock that may go on for some time.
As you say, Ben, there is a financial constraint because it is a global economic shock. So for any of those countries, every cent has to count. Does this mean when we're thinking about policy, we have to focus on what we know works?
You know, I would say yes and no. And of course, in general, to the extent we have policies that are based on rigorous evidence, of course, we want to take that evidence into account. But the reason I said yes and no is that the other thing that is really important is in a time of crisis, it's important to be able to react quickly. And what that means is building on whatever structures or systems or programs are already in place in a given country. So each country is going to have, because of their own history and their own kind of previous policies, different sets of institutions that could be available to deliver assistance to those in need. And they're going to have to build on what they have. So, you know, we might have a program that we think has the best evidence in country A, but if country B doesn't have those systems in place right now, in a normal time, we might say they should take the time to build up the right systems to be able to follow kind of the best policy. Today, they may need to be a little more flexible to adapt to be able to use the principles we have for delivering social assistance well, but in a context that builds on the institutions they already have. That being said, there are some general principles, both from our own research and other research, that I do think are important to the extent that countries can take them into account. One of the systems that is commonly used to identify who is the most needy beneficiaries for aid in developing countries are so-called asset tests, right? So countries can't observe people's income, but they can, you know, go door to door and figure out whether you have a dirt floor, whether you have a TV or other assets that you own that predict your income. And many countries in the developing world use those kinds of asset tests. Those work well in normal times when you're trying to target long-run poverty, but they may not give you everyone you want to target now when you're interested in people who have received economic shocks. So you need other kinds of approaches to identify people who have recently received shocks. One approach that our research in Indonesia found was effective was community-based targeting. And there the idea is to give a certain amount of aid to communities and tell them to identify who are the people in their community who've been most hardest hit who aren't covered by existing programs. That's a strategy that we found could be effective in Indonesia, even in normal times, that we think has a lot of applicability today.
Rima, one of the ways to build on this, what's already in place, is to enrol more people for means-tested cash transfers. But even if you're living in the UK or the US, that tends to take a while, and we don't have a long time to be able to do this. What did your research in Indonesia tell you about whether self-targeting could be efficient for this?
I think the research does say it could be efficient, and what's nice about it could be done relatively quickly. So just taking a step back a bit, in a lot of developing countries, there's not a lot of information about who's actually poor, and so it's very challenging to do the means testing. So what many countries do is they do these periodic surveys where they collect a number of different assets that are easily verifiable. And those are used to determine, you know, if I have a TV, if I have a very nice roof, I probably am not in need of assistance. Whereas if, you know, I have a dirt floor, I don't have a table, I don't have a television, I'm probably very poor and in need of assistance. And so they use this permanent part of your income to determine whether or not you actually need help. But now is a very different time. Now is a time where there's a lot of people who might have a television, might have a nicer roof, but they just lost their job. Their business has to be shut down because of the social distancing. And so because of this, many more people are probably going to be needed to be included in the safety net than before. One way to do this quickly is what Ben talked about earlier, is through the community-based targeting. Another way to do it is our research shows that you can actually screen in people who are most in need if you open it up and let people self-identify and self-apply that they actually need assistance. And the way to do it is twofold. One is to have a little bit of a cost to doing so. So there has to be some paperwork that you have to fill out or something to make it very clear that this is for people who are unemployed and who can take the time to go through these steps to actually get the assistance. The second is usually there's some sort of verification that's done in the background. And here is where I think we have to be a little bit creative about different ways to do it. And so while some of these ideas might not have necessarily been tested in the past, but ideas about, for example, can you use cell phone records to predict people's income status? Can you use, you know, electricity bills, different types of systems in place to see if you can actually do a little bit of verification in the background quickly?
And one thing our research suggests is important is if you make people apply to something and they think they're going to be verified later, many people who forecast that they're not going to make it through the verification step won't bother to apply. And that can be useful really in normal times, because sometimes actually the government wouldn't necessarily know all the information those people have, so the government can get information. It could be particularly useful now because it means that the government can get a lot of the benefits of that verification up front, even though they're not going to be able to do it till a little bit later.
We also need to get the money that we transfer quickly and efficiently to the people that need it. This is always a problem. I think the evidence shows that mobile money has really worked, doesn't it? I guess in this situation, it also avoids physical contact as well.
I think mobile money is a great option. As you said, as the research has shown, has done tremendous things in areas where it's been expanded. I think it's a bit of a challenge in some countries where the systems are not as developed. For example, in Kenya, mobile money is very common, and I know they're doing cash transfers throughout the whole country based on the mobile money systems. But for a lot of other countries where the systems are not very developed, it's challenging to introduce it at exactly the same time as so many other things are happening. And so then I think you need to spend a little bit of time being a little bit more creative about how you can get money out to citizens, particularly when you want to take into account the social distancing. And so, you know, some of it might be thinking through providing additional debit cards, but at the same time, you'd need to make sure there's money in the banks, particularly in rural areas, which might not have as much cash on hand at small kiosks and ATMs, to make sure that money's flowing there. It could be through cash distribution centers, in which case you might want to think about having different days for the week that people can come and pick up the cash, and rules in place for how many people could be in the building at the same time. And so I think the digital technology is great when it's working. And for countries where the digital technology, where either people have mobile money, where a large majority of the country has bank accounts, I think doing things digitally is wonderful. But I think we also have to acknowledge that there's a lot of country where these systems aren't yet set up. And introducing them at the same time is just going to create delays when you're trying to get cash out.
So thinking about health insurance, optimally, you'd like to get a lot of people to sign up to the existing programs quickly so they can get the healthcare that they need. But people tend to put this off for a lot of understandable reasons. I think this is also something you researched in Indonesia, isn't it, to find out what really works in driving sign-ups to health insurance programs.
Just to step back for a second, countries have different approaches to health insurance. Some countries basically have government-provided health insurance for everyone. Other countries provide health insurance to poor citizens, but ask everyone else to sign up for insurance and pay contributions themselves. In the latter case, in the developing world, enforcing a mandate that you buy insurance, like they have in the US, for example, can be quite challenging because there aren't sort of great enforcement mechanisms. In those cases, it's very hard to get people to pay for insurance. Many people don't want to do it. Insurance demand, not just for health insurance, but for many different types of insurance in the developing world is low. One thing that we did in Indonesia was to look at a couple of different strategies for increasing take-up of insurance. There are a couple of key findings. One, I think, really important finding is that temporary subsidies for insurance can be effective in terms of getting more people to sign up. And not only that, but what we found is that when the subsidy is taken away, those people can actually continue to keep paying for the insurance themselves. Not all of them, but some fraction of them. So temporary insurance subsidies could be a way during the current crisis to extend health insurance coverage to many people. And I think one of the findings of our research is that doing that doesn't sort of get people used to the idea that the insurance will be free and they won't pay for it in the future. Actually, the opposite. You know, once people have the experience of insurance, they're more likely to continue to pay for it in the future. So a policy that might make sense to increase insurance coverage now actually could have some benefits in the long run. The other sort of issue with insurance is adverse selection. That's the idea that only the sick people sign up for insurance. We also find that these temporary subsidies can reduce adverse selection, get more healthy people into the pool, which can help make health insurance more sustainable in the long run. So for those reasons, we think it's a policy that can be both be effective now for increasing health insurance coverage during the crisis period, but also might have some long-run benefits in terms of increasing access to health insurance.
What we find in our research that healthier people sign up for the health insurance when there's a full subsidy and it's made free. But at the same time, what's very interesting is that we see those same individuals using the health system much more. And particularly in a time of COVID where health systems might be stressed, if you are doing these health insurance expansions, I think at the same time, you want to make sure there are regulations in place that people are not coming in for elective surgeries.
Because resources are so scarce, there are inevitably always going to be arguments about conditionality. Can you clear up some of the debates about that? The first is, do welfare recipients get lazy?
The answer is a resounding no. This debate about whether or not welfare recipients are going to be lazy has come up quite often in many countries around the world, even in the debates right now in the US about the fiscal stimulus and the expansion of the unemployment insurance system. What we show in our research is that even in the good times, we looked at what happened when cash transfer programs were extended in six countries around the world. And what we find is a very clear zero. People are already working, they don't work less. And then when you combine that with other work that we do that shows that these cash transfer programs have a lot of benefits for children in terms of health and nutrition, it's basically a win-win. But I must say that even regardless of our research, this is a very different time. It's not that there are all these jobs out there and the cash transfers might be preventing people from working. We're asking people not to go into work for the good of society, in which case we do need to provide assistance.
And secondly, Ben, should we worry that if we give assistance to people at the moment, they're going to blow it all on luxuries?
No, this is not a big concern. I think that there's a variety of studies. They look at things like, do people consume more cigarettes or more alcohol when they get cash transfers? And they basically don't find any evidence of that. I think basically people, when they are really in need and they get some additional assistance, they tend to focus on the things they need the most.
I'm going to ask both of you about this. What does the evidence tell us will be the most important principles of a policy now to support vulnerable people through this COVID-19 pandemic?
I think there's two things that we really need to consider in the current crisis. First, we need to move quickly, which means that we need to use the existing systems that are in place in countries and not just create a lot of new programs outside the system that take time to develop. This means that the approaches might look very different in each country because each country might have very different institutions in place in terms of delivering social assistance. The second factor is that I really do think it's important that people understand that we do need to provide assistance to the poorest of the poor, which is generally done in these social assistance programs. But this is a very different crisis that's affecting many different types of people. And we may have to go higher up in terms of the income distribution in terms of who we provide social assistance to. This means we need to be a lot more innovative and creative in both our methods of identifying who are those who need the assistance and how to actually reach them.
I think I'd also add that I think a combination of approaches makes sense. Each existing program is going to have some gaps. And given that, it seems like you want to have multiple different approaches to try to minimize those gaps. I think it's also important to make sure that at least one of those approaches has some flexibility. It could be flexible enrollment. It could be a community-based method, because those flexible methods are just really important to help make sure that you have some mechanism to make sure that you're not leaving out anybody who is really vulnerable, really in need, who just didn't meet some other kind of bureaucratic criteria. The other thing I'd stress is, you know, I don't think we can let the perfect be the enemy of the good right now. There's urgency to getting some of these programs out. Time is really of the essence, and so now is the time to act.
That's very interesting. Rima, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ben, thank you as well.
Thanks very much.
Now, there's a super long reading list for you after this one, but your first reference point is an article that Rima and Ben wrote for Project Syndicate, and that was called Cushioning the Poor from the COVID-19 Shock. But many of you will want to go back to the papers that are relating to things we discussed in today's podcast. I'm afraid I can't give you all the authors because that would be the length of another podcast in itself, but the titles are Income Risk and the Benefits of Social Insurance, Evidence from Indonesia and the United States. That's a chapter in the NBER book, Fiscal Policy and Management in East Asia from 2007. Then Self-Targeting, Evidence from a Field Experiment in Indonesia. That was published in the Journal of Political Economy in 2016. An article from Science in 2016 called The Long-Run Poverty and Gender Impacts of Mobile Money. A working paper from 2020, recent one, Subsidies and the Dynamics of Selection, Experimental Evidence from Indonesia's National Health Insurance. Then there's Debunking the Stereotype of the Lazy Welfare Recipient, Evidence from Cash Transfer Programs. That's a working paper from 2016 that reanalyzes previous studies. And finally, The Lack of Distortionary Effects of Proxy Means Tests, Results from a Nationwide Experiment in Indonesia. That's another working paper from 2020. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. You can find more of our episodes at voxdev.org. And don't forget to subscribe to Vox Dev Talks on your podcast platform.